You're listening to a podcast by BI Norwegian Business School.
Welcome to a new episode of Stay Ahead, a podcast from BI Norwegian Business School. This season, we're exploring entrepreneurship, going beyond the startup. We're talking to entrepreneurs who've done it and researchers who've studied it about how entrepreneurs overcome the challenges of growing a new business. I'm your host, Susanna Pinnock. I'm doing a PhD in entrepreneurship here at BI and have some entrepreneurial experience myself too. Our topic today is platform businesses, particularly digital platforms. So I'm delighted that one of my guests is Andy Chen. Andy was the founder CEO of music platform Tidal. He is an entrepreneur, investor, and business advisor with interests in entrepreneurial businesses as diverse as restaurants and energy, which I hope you'll tell us some more about. I'm also joined by Johannes Lowe, an assistant professor in the Department of Strategy and Entrepreneurship here at BI Norwegian Business School. Johannes studies digital platforms and online communities and has published research on how platforms compete and how social media affects user engagement with platforms. So a warm welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Andy, can I ask you to kick us off and take us back to the early days of Tidal, when you were first thinking about the business and setting it up? What was your drive? What was the dream for Tidal and its growth?
So maybe it's important to at least remind the audience that Tidal came from something else. So initially there was a quite local Norwegian music streaming service called Wimp. Why did you change the name?
Yeah.
Actually, you know, it's an acronym for wireless music player.
Okay.
And I think, let's say the consideration for global brand relevance was not necessarily the main focus for the team at that time. So the service was called Wimp, and you know, it actually grew to a certain fair size in Norway. At one point, it had the similar user base as Spotify. But then after that, I think we know what happened. Spotify took off and Wimp didn't really take off. Mm-hmm. Now, the birth and the genesis of Tidal was, it wasn't random. It was quite calculated and scientific.
Right.
And it started off with more the infrastructure. Infrastructure meaning the reason people were listening to music through MP3 was simply because the bandwidth was an issue many, many moons ago. And that became a limitation for how heavy the file could be when you actually stream and compress. So they had to compress everything. Mm-hmm. And so back in 2014-ish, we realized that, you know, the whole world was going more or less towards 4G, 5G at that time. Bandwidth wasn't really an issue, and certainly wasn't an issue for, let's say, home internet and any type of connections. And so the question popped in is like, why are we limited to MP3 formats when there are actually higher sound quality files that can be streamed? I mean, you know, generically known as CD quality or lossless files, they predated Tidal, obviously. But they're more related to physical CDs and, you know, more physical form. So the idea was to investigate and analyze where are the market opportunities, because Wimp, which was actually under the holding company, listed company in Stockholm called Aspiro. Aspiro is a public entity where I also became the CEO of Aspiro. Aspiro was a public company that has been listed for well over a decade at that point already. And I wouldn't say it's been a spectacular growth stock. I think our bankers would say that it was the voted top 20 worst stock in the OMX Nasdaq Stockholm history at that time. And so it was nobody was buying really the shares. There was no kind of trading that much. I think the shareholders and the controlling shareholders, they wanted something different. They wanted to kind of identify what are the opportunities. Because as we all know, even for Spotify today, you know, until since the beginning, it's been a loss-making business. And so we know that, well, we knew that at the time, that something had to be a little bit different. The question was what? Now, previously, I spent quite a few years in London. I was responsible for Viacom Europe on the digital business. And so that included MTV and, you know, 300 different sites in which Viacom owned. And but one of the interesting things was the launch of HD, high definition channels, TV channels. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you remember, for those of us that are old enough, it used to be a choice whether you buy a TV and you say, is it HD ready or is it not HD ready? At one point in time, there was a decision that consumers have to make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then in a span of 1 or 2 years, every screen from small to big was HD ready. And when the hardware was ready, the software, meaning at that time the HD channel, we decided to launch MTV HD across Europe. And so here you have an interesting, you can say, market dynamics where hardware was ready and then software came.
So it was hardware that created the opportunity.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And if it was just the hardware, just the software, then the hardware wasn't there to catch it. Right. Mm-hmm. So if you launch the HD channel too early, most people won't be able to enjoy it because most of their TVs were not HD ready, which means they're not going to pay a premium for such premium content.
I see. Okay. So you identified.
Yeah. So we identified a very similar market dynamics at that time for music. And now some of the indications, you know, we also analyze the growth and the sales of Sonos, which at that time, this is dating back in 2013, 2014. It was one of the fastest growing hi-fi sound systems, audio systems, and it was one of the most affordable ones. And at that time, if I remember correctly, for just 200 euros, you could get Sonos One, which is very, very solid hi-fi product, hi-fi speaker. And also, if you think back, this was also the period when headphones were making a comeback. I'm not just talking about Beats, but Beats obviously made it very trendy and fashionable to have quote-unquote high-quality audio headphones. But all the other high-end headphones were also growing. So there's this hardware, you know, trend, you know, essentially marinating and brewing in the market. Mm. And that's where kind of combined with, again, some insights and say, well, you know what, why don't we go for something different and create a niche for ourselves to be the world's number one instead of being number eight and doing the same thing as everybody else?
Can I ask something about this?
Sure.
So, right. I mean, of course, you know, high quality sound hardware is like the one thing. But also, I mean, was it for you kind of a projection exercise to what extent these hardware products, high quality earphones would be adopted as well? Because I think, especially in the early days and nowadays as well, most people probably listen to very cheap
which is
kind of a bottleneck for hi-fi audio formats. Yeah. So how did you decide this?
So I spent, you know, previous to MTV, Viacom, and obviously Tidal, Aspiro, I spent 10 years on the agency side, marketing agency side, digital agencies. So I was involved from launching, you know, anything from consumer brands like Adidas Originals to Philips to, so I think one of the things that I remembered was kind of consumer insights. Mm-hmm. Now, quality never goes out of style. And once you have experienced quality, very few people will say, you know what, I prefer bad quality, because once you have it, you want to hold on to it. Mm-hmm. Sound quality is the same. Mm. Video is also the same. You know, once you've seen HD, you can't go back to watch this granulated, you know, like blurry picture, because it just doesn't look good and you don't want to have it. So quality only goes one way. So once you've achieved a certain quality, it rarely goes backwards. Right. So regardless of the forward-looking projection of hi-fi or high-quality sound equipment, we knew it was only going to be more. The market was going to be bigger than whatever it was at that time.
Right.
And so convenience, quality, these were two things that never go out of style. And they were kind of quite fundamental to how we decided to take this this risk to go into hi-fi streaming. So yeah, so that was one of the main reasons. And also, I think statistically, you know, we looked at, and this is from my previous kind of agency days, if you look at any population, any market, any product category, roughly 15 to 18% of the people would consider trying out something, quote unquote, better.
Okay.
Right. And that's the reason you have Zara and you have Louis Vuitton, right? You have Toyota and you have Mercedes-Benz, you know, so any category, doesn't matter what it is, we estimated around 15 to 18% of the people would be open to trying it. Doesn't mean they will become customers, but they're open to it. So that was also another consumer insight foundation to say, okay, our job is not to necessarily become the world's number one because the market wasn't mature enough.
Right.
And it would be foolish to believe that you can go from, you know, a small company to all of a sudden the world's biggest. I mean, even Spotify took a long time.
Right? Yes.
So so we kind of knew that it was going to take time, but we had to create a defensible position to make ourselves kind of the niche number one. Because that has much more teeth than being, again, number eight of every of doing generic things like everyone else is doing.
A bit of me too,
Right.
So I do want to ask you about how you went about attracting early customers, and you've hinted at how you're differentiating yourself. But just for the sake of the listeners, I want to ask Johannes to define for us what is a platform business, and fundamentally, in what ways does it differ from, like, another kind of startup business that you might think about, a manufacturer or a retail or something else?
Right, yeah, gladly. So when we think about platform businesses, what we basically think about are firms that occupy some sort of a central position and making their business connecting their customers, right? And enable direct interactions between them. That's a little bit distinct from a retailer, for example, who would, you know, buy inventory from some, you know, supplier, take on the inventory risk, and then sell it with a margin to customers. In platform-based businesses, it's more about connecting customer groups, can be distinct groups, and then monetizing these interactions. There's many examples, of course. So we can think about e-commerce platforms, Finn.no, eBay, or whatnot, where the platform owner does not take any stock or inventory, but, you know, all the inventory risk basically remains with the supplier or the seller. And they control the terms of the transactions, and, you know, the platform owner makes a profit by taking a cut of the transaction, right? Other examples are Uber, for example, never been profitable in their core business, but they enabled interactions between riders and drivers. You have Airbnb, very popular example, connecting hosts to travelers. And, you know, all of these firms don't take inventory or these risks, but just monetize the direct interaction. And this can be attractive because it enables low-cost structures because you don't have inventory. And it can scale well if you manage to get network effects rolling. Network effects basically meaning the more participants you have on the platform, the more useful the platform becomes. When we think about a streaming platform, for example, the more music is available there, the more artists, the more attractive it is for the consumers or listeners, you know, because they have a broader range of choice. And vice versa, as for the artists, it's more attractive to list some of their music on a specific streaming platform when they can hope to, you know, get a lot of listens, which, you know, gets them some money in return.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And, you know, the promise is network effects that can, you know, in combination with these low cost structures, can enable scaling, which is fantastic. But it also can be very risky because, you know, when you start out a platform, you don't have any sellers or buyers. You don't necessarily have artists or listeners or riders and drivers. So one of the fundamental challenges is the so-called chicken and egg problem in attracting the initial customers to build network effects from. And I think we, you know, you touched, Andy, on some strategic measures you can take, right? So one thing that we know from research, for example, is to get a foothold, it can be good to identify a profitable niche that can be small initially, right?
Mm-hmm.
But can provide an initial foothold. So there's many examples for this. For example, delivery platforms that connect restaurants to people who want to eat something, they tend to start small in, you know, specific geographic locations where they can actually go to individual restaurants and help them get an attractive listing. To have some restaurants on board to attract initial customers and get some network effects going from which to scale, right? And that's my rundown of the platform business plan.
I think you said something pretty interesting, and I think I'll just support that because I think it's quite true. Is mm-hmm. that the interactions between the entities now, whether it's a user or a musician in the case of streaming or a seller.
Mm.
When you have such interaction, that is when it becomes a little more dynamic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because the opposite of a platform business, I think it's just a linear business, right?
Yeah, retail business.
Yeah. But, when you add in user reviews, user interactions, you allow people to form communities. And in the case of music streaming, and this might be, this is kind of old news now since we're in 2023. Mm. But looking back at that time, one of the key insights was, emotional assets, which is create your playlist.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. When you create your playlist, now whether your playlist is from you following somebody else or your friends, mm-hmm. or in Wimp's case or Tidal's case was more curated. Mm-hmm. We have editors that curated songs and playlists.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you followed them or you follow your friends,
yes.
These emotional assets,
that
is actually what keep the users there.
Yeah.
And of course, if you overlay that with the brand promise of quality, convenience, and everything else in between, I think that's where you have a pretty interesting platform business.
Right.
Yeah.
I like the note about the playlist a lot because this phenomenon kind of shaped and altered listening behavior of consumers quite a bit, right? So there are people who call it the great rebundling of songs, right?
Mm-hmm.
From having a bundled album that is, very much what an artist had in mind.
Yeah.
But, what these playlists basically do, they take these songs out of the album and reshuffle them into an either curated playlist or a user-generated playlist. And they're quite meaningful also in terms of monetizing this from an artist's perspective. So I think a lot of managerial effort from the label side now goes into effort to get into these curated playlists that can be, very popular. And, being part of such a playlist can make a difference in thousands of dollars in streaming revenue.
Yeah, so it's 100%. Yeah. It used to be, artist needs to launch an album, which is, a collection of songs.
Right.
And they say which order it's to be played in, and
correct.
It's on a
vinyl
disc.
And it was
CD
quite scientific in a way. I mean, I spent a couple of years on the label side working for Interscope in the US, and it is not random. They just put it like that. Certain percentage is reserved for airplay, on radios. Certain songs are supposed to be commercial hits depending on the artist. So it was quite scientific in their own ways. Mm. But I think streaming has made that business completely upside down in many ways because it's not about albums anymore. You can release one song and that one hit is a mega hit, right? You get 100 million streams or 500 million, whatever.
Mm.
Then you're gold.
Right. Look at Psy at YouTube.
Sure.
The guy with Gangnam Style. Who had that was the only piece of music he put out. Not even on a streaming platform, only YouTube. It gather what, billion views?
It was a global hit.
Yeah, and he's living off that, forever.
And now there are offshoots, meaning a lot of music related businesses. They're now acquiring catalogs, right? Because let's say a catalog might contain 500 songs, for example. It might be less, might be more.
Mm-hmm.
But you just need to identify a few single songs from the entire portfolio, and if you own the portfolio, the rights to these potential mega hits, then it's a royalty payday for a long time.
Yeah.
So you were talking, Johannes, about how this whole phenomenon of streaming has changed the way that we listen to music in terms of how we order it and how we, you know. So Johannes, talk a little bit about the competition between these platforms then, because in the old days, when you had different artists signed to different labels, we as consumers, we didn't really care whether they were signed to label A or label B, but these labels competed for good artists and lots of customers and that sort of thing. But how do platforms compete and how do they try and hold on to their users or indeed artists?
Right. I guess one of the issues that some regulatory agencies might have is that a lot of times large platforms don't really compete. A lot of times you have platform markets that are dominated by single incumbent large players. And the reason why we see this is rooted in network effect. Right? Mm-hmm, as I said, it's better for everybody the larger a platform is, in a sense, because network effects are higher. You have more music to choose from. You have more customers to monetize your music with. And this can create these winner-take-all dynamics, which basically means you see few dominant players dominating certain markets.
I think in any commoditizing industry, one of the most undervalued assets a company can build or can have is brand. Mm-hmm. And it really is brand, right? Because a brand is a direct reflection of your vision and your ambition in a way, right? That's your brand.
Yeah.
And your brand and brand from a consumer perspective, a brand only exists in the minds of a consumer. And that's not my words. That's like an old adage from advertising. And which means that if you get in there, then you're there. That's why people say out of sight, out of mind, right? Like if you don't see it, if you don't care about it, then it will never be in your head. But once you get in there, then it's a choice because the brand you choose says something about you. And I use that silly example. That's why, you know, some people want to buy luxury goods, luxury cars. They want to buy certain products because of the fact that this brand says something about me or about them as a consumer. So, you know, I think a Tidal was very much a brand-led exercise because, you know, during that time and, you know, when it was just WIMP initially, there was a difference, for example, between the library size that a streaming service could access. Mm-hmm. Spotify had more, you know, I remember at one point Spotify had like 24 million tracks in the library and WIMP at that time had like 15. So obviously it's, you know, comparing library size, you're not going to find certain songs on WIMP, right? But very quickly, the labels also caught on. So then they democratized that and they said, you know what? Everybody can have 24 million.
Yeah.
Then all of a sudden that competitive advantage that some players had, it was erased in a matter of a couple months.
Yes.
Because then everyone is like, hey, I got 24 million, you know, tracks in my library.
Right.
So now you really have to choose.
Okay.
And I think this, you know, I'm a strong advocate that, you know, software companies, of course, you have capabilities, technical competence, and et cetera. But at the core, each successful software company has a very distinct set of philosophies or values. And I'm not talking about like company values, like, you know, we work together. That's not sharp enough. There's no teeth to that.
Mm. It's values for the customer's mind.
Correct.
Right.
So, you know, that you want to make people choose. And I always say this to, you know, pretty much, you know, either the companies I'm involved with, invested, or even my classes, is that you want to force yourself into a binary outcome. Mm-hmm. You want people to choose because when they don't choose, you lose, especially if you're the challenger.
Yeah.
Well, so you want to choose, right? Because people talk about, oh, we're going to build this crazy AI algorithm, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, but so is another team, another development team. Mm-hmm. They all want to build the same things. Okay. But at the end, you know, your brand is your vision and your vision is a set of principles that you create for you. This is a set of values that you create for yourself. Mm-hmm. And that is actually, so you want the customers to choose. B2B or B2C, in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, good.
So having launched a platform business, some years ago and learned from that. How does that inform what you think about platform businesses now? You're an investor. Someone comes along to you and says, hey, I've got this great idea for a platform business. What's your advice to them or warning to them maybe?
I would say personally, I don't invest in platform businesses today. Mm-hmm. I think for me, platform businesses are quite CapEx heavy, quite intensive when it comes to investment. You have exponential amount of venture funds out there, you know, trying to deploy capital. And I think venture funds or investors with very, very large wallets should kind of reserve the right or the first right of refusal to do the platform business.
So you really need deep pockets to get a platform business.
I believe so.
And a long horizon by the sound.
And I also think platform businesses take time because there are just, I mean, everyone is trying to be a platform, but how many platforms can you have, right? And then, you know, we haven't seen this as much in Europe, but in Asia, you have these super apps, right?
WeChat.
They do, WeChat being one of them. You have a lot of these super apps where it's a payment method. It's what you use to order cabs. It's what you use to order food. It's how you bank, do banking, and how you plan travels, how you talk to your friends, everything in one. So in Asia, you have that. And to a certain degree, you have, you know, in the US as well. But my point is to say these companies didn't come from like 200,000 euros. I mean, they never raised 200,000 euros. You know, it's more a couple zeros after that from the beginning. And then if you had to look at, you know, geographically where you located, you know, is your market or is your residence domestic market favorable towards creating that platform? Do you have enough domestic users to actually validate this business? Or you can say, of course, you know, you want to be international from day one. It's not as easy as you think, right? To go international from day one, the opportunity lies in the global niche. That's why you got to go niche, right? We benefited from that when we launched Tidal because hi-fi audio files, it's an existing segment. You know, people spend, you know, we talked about Sonos being 200 euros, but that's an entry point. There are plenty of people spending 20,000 euros or more buying sound systems at home, right? And these people at that time, they would never use an MP3 streaming. That's like buying like a Maserati, but use like a Toyota engine, right? It doesn't make sense. So why would you do that? So I think it is, of course, a combination of timing and the market opportunities. But I think today, unless you have, let's say, the team and the vision to attract deep pocket investors, I actually do believe digitalizing historically linear businesses, delivering conveniences in life, help people solve everyday life challenges or hurdles, and then charge a small fee for that. I think that is what I would invest in, and I have started to.
Yeah. Do you want to talk to us a little bit about where you're investing at the moment and the projects you've got ongoing?
I don't want to plug any companies. So I think it would be unfair because if I plug one, then the other ones will say I didn't plug them. So I think I'll keep it neutral by saying I think generally is the domains. So platform businesses or deep tech, that requires, again, significant amount of heavy investments up front. You need a lot of brain power and you need a stroke of luck. You know, there's a lot of people starting companies and you need, and I think the competition is simply just more intense. And you have to last like 10 plus years. Generically, what we refer to, I guess from the industry, is like, you know, every platform business should be aiming for a home run, more or less. It's a baseball reference from the US, obviously. But I would say the opportunities today is between first base and second base. You know, easy, fast convenience, digital conveniences that you can deliver. And you do it quick. And then you go out there and then you charge users 2 euros. 20 kroner just to do this quick.
a lot of them at very low amounts of money.
Correct.
Yeah.
And I guess that's not necessarily a new trend. I mean, microtransactions, microservices, that's, you know, that's not new. Like, it didn't pop up last year. You know, that's been going on for the last 4 or 5 years. You know, small transaction. I mean, most of the gaming companies charge that, right?
Yeah.
And they've made a ton of, well, not just revenue, but profits as a result of that.
Yeah. Well, Johannes, you've done a lot of research, I think, in gaming. Is that
yeah,
right?
I mean, most academic research into platform-based markets is in gaming, actually, because you have good data there, right? And yeah, you're right. I mean, multiplayer games that are subject to strong network effects, they thrive on network effect, on microtransactions, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the idea really is give the game away for free, right? Think about Fortnite that everybody and their teenage kids are playing, and then, you know, they monetize by sending assets in game. But I also wanted to react to something that you said earlier with, first of all, you need deep pockets, right? I mean, there are so many examples today, right? Think about Uber. Uber in this core ride-hailing business was never profitable. They never were profitable, which is why they explored autonomous driving and all of this, fueled by VC money to this day, right? And the reason is, in this case, is very much structural because, you know, they had to have two value propositions to the drivers. Hey, you can earn enough money here, so you do the riding for us instead of any other job. And they had a value proposition to riders, which was you are cheaper than taxis. Right? Mm-hmm. So you had to pay the one side a lot of money while charging the other side with very little money. And, you know, you don't turn a profit with this. And this is what we see in Uber. Okay. Airbnb had its first profitable year, I think 2022, after many, many years. Spotify has never been profitable. Twitter has never been profitable, or maybe briefly. Right?
So forgive a really stupid question.
Yeah.
But if you're the VC, why are you still investing in this? Because that sounds like an unsustainable, unprofitable business.
And
where's the golden pot at the end of the rainbow?
I think we're exiting or have exited kind of a honeymoon phase. Right. So probably, you know, 2015, 2016, you could say we have a platform-based business. We're going to make losses in the end, but we're going to generate network effects. And then in the long run, we're going to be super profitable. And I think this promise hasn't really manifested for a lot of businesses. Right?
Okay.
We also have to consider that it's probably harder than ever to launch a home run, really, right? And the reason is, I mean, we don't have these super apps like WeChat in Europe, but we do have very large players like Google, Apple, that kind of go into all kinds of adjacent services that have nothing to do with their core services. Apple started out as a computer firm, and they are now in payment, they're in streaming, right? They're in, you know, all kinds of things. The same with Google and Amazon, right? So they're the one, they have the deep pockets, obviously. They are like the best example of home runs in the digital platform business. And they go into all of these.
So it's like the platform starts with something, even
exactly.
if it's never going to be a profitable something. But
right.
it uses that almost as a platform in which to evolve into other things.
That's exactly this. So researchers call this platform envelopment, based on a paper that came out in 2011 by Eisenman, Parker, and Van Alstyne. And this is exactly this. If you have an existing user base that is captive, like Amazon has and Google has, you can use this user base to kind of shimmy them over into a related service. Think about Apple Pay, for example. People have your phone. Mm-hmm. They have their account. Why not just add payment and functionality there? The people are already connected, and it's super convenient. So if you want to start a platform yourself, it's super hard. And I think we're at a crossroads right now in terms of regulation, right? Either this is going on like this, then, you know, I think we're going to have WeChat-type apps that is not WeChat, and maybe it's not one single app, but it's, you know, one single firm or few single firms dominating this. Or what we're seeing now is kind of pushing for regulation, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the EU Commission has put out regulation proposals to kind of curb this with data sharing and stuff like this, which could actually curb these big players' ability to do this, which could, you know, enable more startup activity in platform-based markets again. But I'm sympathetic for you saying that you don't invest in this type of business because, you know, when it a business that can scale in a way that is really profitable and a home run into the foreseeable future, then it's probably an area that not a small firm will occupy, but rather that will be born from a larger player.
I think, again, successful large platform business, it never really comes from doing, you know, all the scope of what it does in the beginning.
Yeah.
And I think I have, you know, met startups, you know, then when they're trying to raise money and the founders would say, you know, I want to do like these 10 things. I'm just going to consolidate them.
Mm.
And I think you should never tell someone's ambition as naive because, you know, I think we've all been naive before. But I think practically and realistically speaking, you know, and there's a reason why in startup people say, how do you eat an elephant? From the tail, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why the tail? Because you can actually bite into it because you can't bite an elephant.
Mm. Right.
So you have to start with a small part of the ecosystem and then you gradually eat into it. So a platform business, you know, one, it takes time. And again, it's a big investor's game because most smaller investors, and there are large angels, so I'll exclude them because they are as powerful as funds. But, you know, for small investors, the hope of actually being a part of that super app, it's like, I think that was like 20 years ago, 10, 20 years ago. Today is very, very difficult. It's much better to go niche, to kind of be the, instead of being the jack of all trades, you are the master of one. And then once you mature, you can also, you know, once you wedge yourself into the ecosystem, then you expand from there. And I think anyone or any player that actually has access to the user's wallet or payment, you're looking at any, it's one pivot away, one large pivot away from doing something else, right? Because I have your wallet. You just need to click here and then I can help you buy this and buy that. And this is what Klarna is doing, right? Klarna is now becoming a fashion or say shopping portal when it used to be payment.
Yeah.
Right. And because now they can do a lot more because they have your payment. So why not just, they just curate your shopping. They know what you're buying.
Yeah.
So, so again, I think any payment company is potentially one large pivot away from becoming something super crazy and, and, you know, big. It depends on, you know, what the investor appetite is, which unfortunately at the current moment, the investor appetite is not that wild. I think everyone is much more, like Johannes said, it's been corrected, this kind of crazy valuation, as we all know, the last 2 years. It's been pretty brutal for startups when it comes to valuation. So there's a lot of value destruction in that process.
Maybe not so much a bubble bursting, but a balloon kind of just deflating rather quickly. Maybe just...
I think it's difficult. Kind of bursting.
It's bursting. Mind. Okay, we'll go for that.
I think it's, it bursted last year.
So on that very modest note, I'd like to thank my guests, Andy Ten, Johannes Lowe. Thank you so much for a very, very interesting discussion.
Thank you.
And thank you.
Have a great rest of your day.
This is a BI production. Listen to more podcasts. Go to bi.no/podcasts.